This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
We walk down by the Buckeye Creek to see the froggy, the goggle eye, to hear that west wind whistle to the east. There ain't nobody that can sing like me.
Ain't nobody that can sing like me.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Voices of the Middle East with Gudars Ektidari. They are talking about drone warfare with guests Trudy Cooper and Linda Wenning, just back from a visit to Pakistan with Code Pink.
And there ain't nobody that can sing like me. Ain't nobody that can sing like me. Way over yonder in the minor key. Way over yonder in the minor key.
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KBOO will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kboo.fm/2013MLK.
Hi, this is Per Fogring, host of Fight the Empire. Thursday, I'll be talking with film director Oliver Stone and historian Peter Kuznick. Together, they have produced a 10-part television series and a 700-page book called The Untold History of the United States. That's Thursday, January 17th at 9:30 a.m. A talk with Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick on KBOO, your radio station.
Hello, welcome to another installment of Voices of the Middle East. This is Gudars Ektidari, your host. The program today is the first show in 2013. We have passed another year, and our program basically enters the 12th years of existence. We started 2001, right after the 9/11, and it's a great pleasure and honor to be part of the KBOO community, and for many programs that we've had, we talked about different issues, and I tried to cover basically all of the Middle East, but specifically wherever the action is. Our definition of Middle East goes beyond academic dimensions and borders, and we have, for that reason, we have gone to South Asia and also into Afghanistan as well. And today we are going to talk about the issues related to the unmanned plane, normally called as drones. And I have two very good guests and friends who are coming back from a peace mission to Pakistan, and been in the area and met people. It's a great pleasure to welcome Linda Wenning, who is a retired CPA living in Beaverton. She's a member of the Portland Mennonite Church, and she was on a peace mission to Pakistan. And with me also is Trudy Cooper. She's a very good friend, a peace and justice activist, an independent consultant, and also a member of American-Iranian Friendship Council. They went to Pakistan on a mission with Code Pink. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Maybe we start with Linda. How did you get involved with this trip, and what basically interested you in going with Code Pink?
I heard about a speech that Madea Benjamin gave at the Peace House in Northeast Portland, and she had a sign-up sheet saying, if you want to go to Pakistan, just sign up here. And I signed up, and the rest of it's history.
And Trudy, how did you get involved?
Well, similarly, I used to work in the Peace House, and I managed to live in the Peace House, and went to Medea's presentation there, and was really, I had been reading about drones and felt very frustrated about, and wanted to understand more immediately, so I was really surprised when she said, well, we're going to take a peace delegation there. And at first I thought, oh, I can't possibly do that, I have to work, et cetera, et cetera. And then my next thought was, I really have to do this. So then it was just a matter of trying to get the resources together to be able to.
Can you give us a synopsis of this whole technology and how it has developed to the state that it has today, the different types of drones, and what are the purpose of using them?
Yes, drones have been around for quite a while. I mean, technically, they've been around since the beginning of the 20th century, but the kind that people are looking at now have come into use. There were seven only, I think, militarized drones in 2001, and now there are, I think it's 7,000. So they have really rapidly increased. They are robotic. They are, you know, meaning they are not manned. They are operated from 6,000 or 7,000 miles away from where their targets are. There's seven different bases in the United States that they deploy from, I guess you could say. And there are some international locations as well. And the drones themselves are, they carry, I think, four Hellfire missiles, which are 5 feet long. They travel about 1,000 miles an hour. They have organ-crushing capacity just from the sound waves, and they either incinerate, vaporize, kill people by shrapnel. Almost no one comes out alive. Some do, most don't.
And I assume that most of these are being used by American military and perhaps CIA, is that correct?
Yes, the drone program in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and some other places is a CIA program. So technically, they don't even acknowledge officially that it exists. So it's a really weird, surreal kind of doublethink of, they speak about it, but then at the point where they don't want to answer, they say, well, it's a secret program. We can neither confirm nor deny any figures about it at all, anywhere any of the strikes have been, anything like that. And yet, it's in the, you know, the strikes are in the newspapers, but in many of the newspapers they will say alleged U.S. drone strike or suspected U.S. drone strike. You know, just that strange technical language. So, yeah, it's a CIA program at this point.
Linda?
Yes, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which is based in the United Kingdom, does the best job that I've seen out there to track the drone strikes and how many are killed. It's very difficult because the area where this is happening is not an area where journalists can even go. And so it's hard to get information. But the numbers, at least 149 or 176 children have been killed. And the overall killing is like 2,500 to 3,500 people. And 49 are known militants.
What was the response that you got when you went to Pakistan from the regular people?
The Pakistani people can tell the difference between American policy and Americans. And our Bible teaches us to be hospitable. The Quran teaches people to be hospitable. They've got us beat 100 ways from Sunday. The most hospitable people I ever hope to meet. And so it doesn't matter who you are or whatever, they will take care of you. We were treated royally all the way around.
How long have you been in Pakistan?
I've been in Pakistan twice. I was there in 2000, and then this trip was about 8 days.
And where did you go?
Most of our time was in Islamabad, and then we did take a trip with a political party to try to enter South Waziristan, which is part of the war zone, and the crowd was estimated between 10,000 and 150,000 people.
These are the population of the area?
No, just our caravan.
Oh, okay.
Just our group. It was amazing.
So did you enter Waziristan?
We spent the night in Tonk, which is very close. Someone, I don't know who, had put in barriers to keep us from going on in.
The security forces.
Security forces, yeah. So we were there overnight and left the next day without trying to go further in.
Did you guys have a chance to meet victims of drones?
And yes, we met several, and they were all residents of either North or South Waziristan, and they told us their stories and their losses and when they had happened, and they asked us to bring their stories back to the United States. So it seemed like every time we asked, what can we do to help? You know, as Westerners, as peace activists in solidarity with you, what's the best thing that we could do? And they would always say, tell our stories, tell people we aren't terrorists.
When you say North Waziristan, is that inside Afghanistan, or they both are part of Pakistan?
They're both technically a part of Pakistan, but it's what they call a porous
state.
Border.
Okay.
Technically there's a border, but the tribes tend to overlap the area.
Right.
That area is called the Federally Administered Tribal Areas, FATA. And the people that live there do not have full citizenship with Pakistan. They have their own administrative, their own laws, their own justice system. And it's like we treated the American Indians way back when. They just don't have the rights that regular Pakistani people have.
Do you know what's the population of the of these areas, the Waziristan area?
I don't remember that. I did know. I don't remember that. The area is about the size of Connecticut. Got seven different of the tribal agencies in it. But I can't remember the population. I know that hundreds of thousands have had to leave that have been refugees, but I don't know the total that was originally there.
During the debate before the election, if you remember, there was this question about the number of ships and the Navy vessels, and President Obama responded that the military has changed and we don't have horses and beignets, and this was kind of a reference to the use of drones. What do you think he exactly meant, and do you see a evolution toward unmanned? Well, right now it's from the air, but it's very possible to have robotic soldiers on the ground as well. What do you think about that, and what's the position?
There's every indication that the ramping down of troops, ground troops in Afghanistan, leads to the ramping up of drones. And that is the future arms race is drones, that it's the advantages from the point of view of the nations who have drones, which are primarily the U.S. and Israel, is that there's no risk. I was going to say little risk. There's no risk to our soldiers. And so it's a lot easier sell and a lot easier to dominate, have that geopolitical presence, maintain hegemony if you don't have resistance from home. So that's the appeal. And there are, I can't remember the title of the book right now, but Nick Terse has written a book about the direction of warfare going, you know, and it's just that there's a drone caucus in Congress. It's not an oversight committee or anything like that. It's a cheerleading committee where essentially those particular people on that committee are meeting with the drone manufacturers and lobbyists and trying to make sure they've secured markets all over the world for drone proliferation and domestically as well.
And I think this is a bipartisan thing, because again, during the debate, yeah, Mitt Romney also supported President Obama in using drones. Mm-hmm. What do you see about, I mean, you touched on it, but what do you see the role of military industries such as Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, that are basically manufacturer of these equipments?
It's very frightening. I feel that our government is racing headlong into a military machine, and the domestic stuff is just being crowded out. And if you remember back during Bush times, he was criticized for capturing people and putting them in Guantanamo. He was criticized for that. Well, now what we do is kill those people in the field, along with whoever else is unfortunate enough to be there, without arrest, without trial, without any kind of judicial process. And so it's a war crime.
Again, you touched on the judicial process, and it is astonishing to know that even American citizens have been killed or targeted by these drones in Yemen, for example. Can you give us some of those examples that are you have?
Yeah, there was a man killed in Yemen, and then his 16-year-old son was killed in Yemen, and the son was an American citizen.
They both were.
And there's no acknowledgement or apology or reparation or anything. And so if you flip it the other side, if someone we'll take Pakistan, for example, or Afghanistan, finds an Afghan citizen in New York City that they want to kill, they just go kill them without any thought of arrest, trial, reparations, or anything else, and kill everyone that happens to be in the vicinity. It's not a place I'm comfortable for America to be going.
Which is actually what is happening today. Just yesterday, three Kurdish female rebel who were basically refugees to France were assassinated in Paris in their office, mm-hmm, of Kurdish human rights. So this is not something that it's a fantasy or it's a story. It is, mm-hmm, actually the what is happening. Speaking of John Brennan being nominated as the chief CIA by President Obama. First of all, when you hear John Brennan, what comes to your mind, Trudy?
Well, the drone program is his baby, and he's defended it. He's kind of a paradoxical figure in a lot of ways. I'm not sure everybody knows some of the influences that he's had. Well, for one thing, he started out saying there are no civilian casualties. It's quite a discrepancy. zero and 3,500 is quite a discrepancy. Makes you wonder how anyone could say that. Since then, he backed off of that somewhat, but it's still, he says it's in the single digits, civilian deaths. And more recently, some U.S. officials have said it's in the double digits. So there's that, defending the program that is his. What a lot of people aren't aware of is that John Brennan, more than anyone, has been, just practically speaking, the person who has curtailed the signature strikes for the most part. And I guess we should explain what signature strikes are. But before I do that, he also was the person who was arguing that it not be a secret CIA program, but that it be transferred to the military, where it would have accountability and oversight. So those are interesting things. So now people are asking, well, now that he's going to be probably head of the CIA, is he going to go, well, on second thought, maybe keep that program here? So it's interesting because he has taken some positions recently where the drone strikes until very recently reduced down significantly from what they had been in 2011 and 2010, and that's attributed to him pulling back, apparently having misgivings about how it had gotten out of their control. Now there's, you know, it's proliferated to 75 other countries. They've set precedents that they probably don't want to live with if those are happening from other countries. So it's, you know, we're not assuming he's having a crisis of conscience. We're assuming that strategically he has had questions about it. So it's interesting, you know, what will happen. But yes, he's the father of it. It's his baby. He defends it. And at the same time, he's pulled back somewhat from it.
I know, Linda, you talked about Medea Benjamin, and everybody knows that she basically is one of the founders of Code Pink, and she has had quite several interaction with Mr. Brennan during his press conference a while back, and then just recently after his nomination. Can you just narrate that story that you tell me?
Yes, there's a fascinating, fun YouTube presentation where John Brennan is giving a press conference, and she has somehow or other gotten herself in there, and she's in the second row, and she turns and faces the audience and explains what's wrong with the drone program, and so on, so on, so on. And a woman comes and tries to tug on her sleeve, and nothing happens. And so a big, burly security guy picks her up bodily, and as she is spread-eagled to make it more difficult for him to pick her up, he bodily takes her out of the room, and she doesn't stop talking till after the door slams. So that was
actually, and we that's don't on know YouTube. She stopped then.
Yeah. And then we saw on our email an incident where she and Tig Berry decided to go take a Sunday drive, and they drove to his house and knocked on the door. And he answered, and she again told him what's wrong with the drone program. And his wife appeared and explained that Medea was being rude and slammed the door. And that, rudeness on interrupting their Sunday morning and rudeness on killing people is kind of an interesting contrast, yes.
Correct. Trudy, can you give us a little more information about Code Pink? And I mean, they are almost everywhere these days, at the NRA press conference a few weeks back. Also, there were representatives from Code Pink that took a stage. What is the organization basically a strength coming from?
I think Code Pink is really well known for doing flamboyant actions that not necessarily in huge numbers, but more the dramatization of conflicts and issues, so that whether they're picketing outside of something like Zero Dark 30, or whether they're in front of John Brennan's house, or whether they're crashing a important dinner at the, in Washington, D.C., it gets a lot of media attention because of the flamboyancy. Something that a lot of people don't know is where the name Code Pink comes from. You aware of where that comes from?
No, can you explain?
Yeah, it happened in, I think they founded it in 2003 or 2004, although Madea had the other organization that she founded that she was part of at that time. But it was based on what did they call our warning of how afraid we were supposed to be based on the colors of orange or red or et cetera? What was that called?
TSA.
The terrorism color code thing that we had, right after 9/11. So Code Pink was sort of a satirical reference to that.
To that coloring.
Yeah.
Except pink for peace.
Right. So how many of you went to Pakistan on this trip?
I heard 32. We were in two minibuses, and we had one Canadian, and the rest from all over the United States.
And who did you meet on your trip?
Oh, they had a full schedule for us. We met university professors and students. We met attorneys that are involved with working with the victims, attorneys that are working from the law aspect, various activists. We had a press conference with the political party.
Human rights groups, the Bar Association, probably most significantly the ambassador, Richard Hoagland, the acting ambassador, Richard Hoagland. That was a big focus of ours, besides the survivors. Yeah. Those were kind of the two biggest events.
Yeah. He told us not to go to Waziristan.
Oh, yeah. In Islamabad.
And our leader, Madea, said, why? Well, there's credible evidence of problems. What's the evidence? Can't tell you. What are the problems? Can't tell you that either. But don't go. And we ignored him.
Okay. What do you think the future of this war entail in Pakistan? I mean, I know there are a lot of violence going on with these bombings that are happening in Pakistan, Shia-Sunni divide, and the whole instability of the central government in most areas of Pakistan, including Balochistan, the Waziristan, and everywhere else. Yeah. What did you take on that?
Pakistan is our ally. Why are we bombing our ally? Okay, and the area that we're talking about of the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, Alexander the Great came through there. He did not conquer that area. The British were there. They didn't conquer it. The Russians were there. They didn't conquer it. We will not conquer it either. And we really, 11 years is long enough to win a war. And if we haven't won it after 11 years, maybe we should not be there at all. It's not something we can solve. It just isn't. And my understanding of that part of the world, our official American government understanding is non-existent, non-existent. One time Hillary Clinton said, why don't you just tell those northern tribal areas what the rules are, how things are supposed to be? No one tells them how things are supposed to be. No one. Not us, not the central government.
I'm speaking with Trudy Cooper and Linda Venning. They just came back from a trip with Code Pink to Pakistan with regards to drone war, so-called war on terror, with drones, which is basically unmanned plane that is used in this war. One question I have for you, Trudy, before you go to your comment. Do you know where these planes are basically taken up?
Are they
taken off from Pakistan, or they're coming all over from Indian Ocean?
There is a base in Afghanistan, as I understand it, that used to be run by what was formerly known as Blackwater, that is run by, so there's that. And then there's another one, I don't recall the location, but local, yes.
In Pakistan?
Mm-hmm.
That are being
in Afghanistan or Pakistan. As far as I know, I don't know of another location.
And with regards to pulling out of Afghanistan, what did you sense if this is going, this operation is going to continue after the so-called pullout of 2014?
Yeah, I keep trying to think that one through. It's really interesting that other than being horrifying, it's really interesting that there, I think the average number of drone strikes in 2012 was every almost, approximately one per week would average out to. Already this year, there have been seven strikes. And today, the 11th?
Yeah.
There's been speculation about what that means, that it is a window of opportunity to take out a bunch of targets before government changes in Pakistan, because they have an election coming right up, and the most prominent candidate would have a very different relationship with the United States than what they have now with Zardari. And that person is Imran Khan, who was our sponsor, was the person who planned, organized, invited people from the international community into his peace march. So this was not our thing. We were invited to their thing. And there were other local organizations also that were coordinating with him. But his, to get to your earlier question about some of the dynamics in Pakistan, he's pretty much, as far as I can tell, the only candidate that has presented a very different alternative approach to handling Pakistan's internal security problems. And that's exactly the way he sees it. He says Pakistan needs to get out of the U.S.'s war on terror. It is not our war on terror. This is not how we would conduct it. There's no long-term goals associated with it. There's no economic development of the region. There's no focus on education. There's nothing. They're just trying to kill their way to some goal, which isn't even our goal. So he's speaking in ways that are usually not, U.S. officials don't have complimentary remarks for people who speak the way Imran Khan speaks. And so one sense I have is that they're trying to get as much done as they can now in terms of taking out Taliban targets, because they've pretty much taken out all the al-Qaeda targets. That they're doing as much as they can during what they may consider to be the window of opportunity. And if Brennan is serious and it's going to go to the military, if the program's going to go to the military, maybe that is also part of it, because it would have congressional oversight once it does that.
Did you want to?
One thing that I found very interesting there is we were told that a year before our visit was in October 2012, a year before our visit, the drones were not even a topic of conversation. And then while we were there, Malala was shot. And she's a 15-year-old student that was advocating for women's girls getting an education. And a year before that would not have been a topic of conversation either. And just in the last two or three months in the United States, the whole drone issue is much more a topic of conversation than previously.
Trudy, you mentioned that there's a possibility of this operation or the control moving from CIA to Pentagon. Is that the war?
Yeah, that was what many have recommended, and more there has been criticism of the drone program. Just in the last few days, the Michael Boyle, for example, who was one of the Obama advisors earlier, and an attorney with the Defense Department, I think his name is Johnson, Jay Johnson, I think that's his name, has said this is a failed strategy. It, you know, isn't effective in the long term. So they're really high-level people who are no longer being referred to in the media as on the condition of anonymity right. phrase that are speaking out against it. So there's rumblings, and I don't know what they mean. And if they're just being allowed now, you know, that there have maybe always been rumblings, but I think that would be one direction that would, you know, sort of lay the sort of pave the way for talk about moving it out of being a CIA program.
The price tag of these operations, what is the average price of these drones that can carry a missile or a weapon? Because I know there are plenty of these are flying all over the world for just eavesdropping and for surveillance and other spying missions. But these are the certain type that can carry a missile.
They're always referred to as being relatively inexpensive, and that being one of the benefits of them. Linda, maybe it looks like you're looking up.
Well, I don't have it at the tip of my fingers. The actual cost of them and the cost to operate them and how many individuals it takes to maintain the drones is huge. The imagined savings is not killing our people, American people. However, the pilots that are flying the drones by remote control suffer from PTSD. And the American military looks at this like, well, maybe their chair is not ergonomically correct or something like that. People are not meant to kill people, and that's what hurts. It hurts the Americans and the Pakistanis.
But I think that they have reduced a kind of a step on the ground, seeing the blood into a video game that most of these gigs are expert on, and they enjoy playing it. So as long as you're not bringing back caskets mm-hmm. and don't have those ceremonies, and you don't have a family member or a person that would go out and advocate for peace against the war, our people are apparently are kind of ignoring the fact that on the other side there are people that are being killed. Similarly, with the regular war, nobody talks about the number of people being killed, for example, in Iraq. All we know is that 5,000 people were killed of American servicemen and women. This at least psychologically, I think, is in benefit of the administration to use and continue doing so and still get the Peace Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm. That's another subject.
So there's no, it looks like there's no end to this story as you see it in the near future.
Well, I wish I was an expert on predicting the future. I think I'd like to comment a little bit about the pilot's point of view of the drone program, because when I first started reading Medea's book and reading all about the PlayStation and the joystick and the way that people were targeted, I must admit I was feeling less sympathetic about the people who were operating them, and understanding that as they had been, you know, selected because as adolescents they were good at video games, and then reading all the military terminology, the usual objectification, like calling them bug splats, because that's the way it looks on the screen, and calling them the rescuers who go in and who are then hit by a second strike, which is a war crime, that they called those squirters. So the usual revulsion, you know, that you feel with that kind of dehumanization that is calculated and that they are actually trained to have. So recently the military has moved to using the term harvest to describe the killing. So our drones are harvesting their children, and that kind of dehumanization, you know, we're familiar with that in war. But recently, well, let me preface this with, it's been really hard to get any stories about what's really going on with those soldiers because it's a secret program. And so while there was a study that was done in 2008, which showed that they had the same rate of PTSD as any other soldier has, and that that was something like 30%, and that 17% were clinically depressed, meaning it had gotten to the point where they were getting divorces and they were using substances, et cetera, where their lives were falling apart. Is higher than than other soldiers. And recently I read an article in Der Spiegel that I think that many people have read and has been reprinted other places, but notably we didn't see articles like that in U.S. media. And they interviewed a young man who's now 27. His name is Brandon Bryant, and he described his feelings and his transitions and what he went through. And it's heart-wrenching. And I don't think he's the only one. I mean, he's not the only one, obviously, with the PTSD figures. That's what it's about. It's about having that sensitivity. So any of our organizing and advocacy has to include the veterans and soldiers' perspectives. That has to be part of what our outreach is. It has to be part of what our understanding and compassion is about, because they didn't make this program. This is not their policy. They're subject to it. Some are may begin being gung-ho about it, but they enter a hell that, you know, is indescribable. The drones can't hear people screaming as they're dying, but the drone pilots see everything. Once they have done a strike, they can see everything that is going on the ground, and that's what this young man describes.
I'm speaking with Trudy Cooper and Linda Wenning. They just came back from a trip to Pakistan with Code Pink and visited people that are somehow impacted by these drone war. If you have any question or comments, you're welcome to give us a call at 503-231-8187. The number is 503-231-8187. And we have our lines open if you have any question or comment. Let me ask you, Linda, from the interaction you had with the regular people or the victims, what is the sense of the people on the other side? How do they feel about this whole...
It's a little bit hard to describe. The part of the world that we're talking about, I use the word tribal, and maybe that isn't the right word, but who you are and who your people are is extremely important, never to be forgotten. And I learned this living in Barrow, Alaska, which is also tribal. And so that sort of thing is really, really important. So when we go in and kill two or three or five or eight members of the same family, we have created 100 more recruits, or maybe 200 more recruits for these insurgent organizations. So it doesn't work. Each time we kill these people, then we create more enemies for the United States. I don't remember the exact figures, but in Yemen, they thought there may be 100 al-Qaeda. Well, now there's 1,000 because we've gone in and killed them. This is counterproductive. It doesn't work. It doesn't make it a safer place for anybody, Americans included.
I have another question before we go. We have some callers waiting. the psychological impact of living in an environment that at any moment you might be target of something like that is mostly like when there are these bomb attacks in the cities, in urban areas. Yeah. And I heard it from like people during the Gaza war that they all heard, or overnight they always hear these whizzes, the noise of the drones flying. What is the psychological impact of that on the targeted communities?
Well, it has. They live 24/7 under the sound of the drones, and it isn't just one drone. They're deployed in groups of four, and the sound. I heard you can get an audio recording of it online, but it's like, so multiply that by four drones, and it's very close. You know, we know how disrupted we feel when there's just a helicopter over the head in our neighborhood.
Sure.
And to them, it means death. It means the threat of death all the time. So people have all kinds of psychosomatic symptoms. They can't sleep. They can't eat. The kids don't go to school. They hide inside.
We have our lines open. Steve, you're on the air.
Thanks. I hope this isn't too far off the point, and if it is, I understand. But someone mentioned earlier Code Pink's protest outside Zero Dark 30, and I was wondering if you would be able to say what that's about and how that relates to your topic.
Yes. It's Zero Dark 30. Are you familiar with the film?
I'm beginning to get familiar with it, and I'm trying to understand where it's coming from and what it's trying to do, and it seems to be very popular.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's very well done. Now, I haven't seen it. I've only read the reviews of it. Most of the reviews are positive. It'll be Oscar-nominated, all of that sort of thing. But the critics of Zero Dark 30, what they say is that the message of the film is that torture works, and it's sort of the formula of no torture, no bin Laden, no safety for Americans.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
And so that's what people are protesting, is that it glorifies torture and that it turns the CIA forces into heroes. And
It just seems odd, because isn't the director the person who did The Hurt Locker, which to me was not a pro-war, pro-nationalistic, pro-American role in the Middle East kind of film?
Yeah, it does seem odd. She has very much defended it, and the way she's responded to the critics is to say, well, I'm just telling the truth about torture. But I haven't read a single critic that has said, don't tell the truth about torture. I mean, I don't know about truth. I guess that's the wrong way to say. She just said, I'm describing something that exists. And they said, we're not objecting to you describing something that exists. We're objecting to really framing this cinematically and powerfully as torture being indispensable as a tool.
And I think the film is basically criticized from both sides of the aisle, and it's also being criticized by right-wing military folks as somehow it shows that the filmmakers have access to secret files of the CIA in the preparation of the of this event. But we have a couple of more people. Thank you, Steve. And now we have another caller. Serena, you're on the air. Oops. Okay. Hello, you are on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on
Hi.
The air.
Okay, great. I had two questions. One is, I wondered if some of the impact on these operators, the soldiers, is that they don't like being in the battlefield. They don't have the sort of camaraderie of the group of their fellow soldiers. And then the other question I had was, I was wondering where these drones are made. I read a long time ago something about this form of technology, maybe this iteration, being created by somebody in Hood River, And so I just kind of wondered where these things are being manufactured, who's benefiting from them. And that's all. Thank you. I'll take it off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. I remember the second question better, so I'll go for that. Boeing is one of the contractors, and they have facilities, I believe, in Hood River and White Salmon, or Bingham, Washington, which is right across the river, General Atomic in Los Angeles. You can just go right down the list of military contractors. I think they've all got their finger in the pie. And the first question...
I think the first question was about the soldiers or the operators of these drones feeling kind of isolated, and which is basically, it might be true, being isolated and not have that camaraderie that soldiers have in the war field.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. And they also lead a very complicated life in that they go to work. They work with a station that has a lot of resemblance to a video game and do that for however many hours. And then they go home and have dinner with their family and bounce their kid on their knee. And so they've got their head in the war, not in the war, in the war. And I think that messes with people as well.
That's true. And as far as the manufacturer of these equipment, it's not just the use of them in the war. It's also being used for surveillance and spying. And currently, it's been even allowed to be used for law enforcement, even within the urban areas. So the prospect of it is very high and very dangerous. And also from the sources, I have heard that there are some Israeli connection to these first manufacturing of the drone for surveillance and spying purposes. Did you want to add something, Trudy?
Off of Linda's answer, also in Oregon is Northwest UAV Propulsion, which is right in McMinnville, very close by. And then in Bend is a company called Outback Manufacturing. The daughter company that Linda was referring to is called In Situ. I think that's how you pronounce it. So we have less manufacturing going on in Oregon than a lot of states do, but we certainly have areas where we can take our protests and actions. Yeah, and what did you just ask before I went back to Linda's question? Sorry.
No. That was just the continuation of the manufacturing. We have another caller, and we have only 7 minutes left. Lori, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to comment on the designation of militant. Mm-hmm. Any male over 16 or anybody else I decide is one, mm-hmm. Is that the idea?
Yes. Yes, that's an opportunity to talk a little bit about the two kinds of strikes. And one of them, as you may be aware, is called the personality strike, which is what it sounds like, where they note the name, the occupation, family members, location of a particular person. And Awalaki, even though that was in Yemen, that was an example of a personality strike, that particular person was being stalked and monitored and found and killed. And his son also deliberately was a personality strike. A signature strike is where behaviors on the ground have the signature of what they call militancy or insurgency. And what that means is that people look like they're plotting something, or they look like they're planting an IED, or they look the part because they're wearing a turban and they have a beard. And so it's very easy if you're in groups of more than one, which isn't even a group, but so people don't even go out because they may be perceived as being a target. And once there has been a strike, I think what you're referring to is the way that people are categorized as either civilians or militants, and any male of what they call fighting age In other words, anybody who has so much as has facial hair will be counted as a militant. So it's a post-mortem designation. It's, you know, kill and you'd say ask questions later, but there's no questions asked later. They're designated a militant. So technically, it's the absurdity of, let's say, a missile strikes a house and there's a father and a mother and a son and a daughter killed, and the son is of military age, then what you'd count up would be there'd be two militants and two civilians that were struck. So that's how crazy, unreal it is.
And I think one thing that I want to add is this definition of militant perhaps comes from John Brennan and his basically co-operators in White House when they said that if there's anybody in a military age in the area where we target, then they must have been up to no good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically the definition that they used for the son of al-Awlaki. So it's very ironic. I mean, if you are talking about, for example, the profile that they're using, for example, having beard or wearing turban, that might be a profile that can be used, mm-hmm. for example, at JFK Airport.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not when you are in Waziristan, because everybody else is the same. So how would they basically signify somebody being really militant is beyond the mm-hmm. word.
And our rules say that people should be confronted by their accuser. They ought to be tried in a court of law and so on. And this bypasses all of that. And then we have the double strike. We haven't talked about the double strike. They send one bomb, and then when people come to help, they send another bomb. And that's a war crime, pure and simple.
Well, we're getting to the close of the program, and I was going to ask you if you have any website address or any kind of recommendation that listeners, if they want to be involved, can connect with Code Pink and your advocacy, if you have anything coming up.
Yeah, well, just very quickly, you can go to the Code Pink site. You can go to a site called Drones Watch, which is kind of networking among a bunch of different peace groups, and then No Drones is another. That would be all a good start. Those also have Facebook pages that are really accessible, so you see things posted, actions posted, articles posted on a daily basis.
And we will have these addresses as a link on our website, either at kboo.fm. You can search for the show, and this will be online, this interview, as well as on my program website, voicesofthemiddleeast.com. We will also post these links there if you want to get access. The final words, Linda, if you have.
I'm very happy to meet you and to have a chance to talk about these issues.
Thank you very much both for being here
Thank
today.
You.
It was very informative, and I hope to talk to you on better topics in the future. Peaceful.
Thank you.
Is proud to help sponsor the Portland Old Time Music Gathering, taking place from January 16th through January 20th at various venues across Portland. The Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering is a grassroots, volunteer-run festival that aims to celebrate and enrich the community of traditional, old-time Appalachian-style string band musicians. A list of performers, locations, and more information can be found at kboo.fm/ 2013 Old Time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
On Wednesday, January 16th, KBOO will broadcast the talk by Michelle Alexander on the new Jim Crow, racism and the criminal justice system, along with a community forum on police and the Portland community. Listen to the talk live on KBOO Radio from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. this coming Wednesday on 90.7 FM and also heard on the web at kboo.fm.
And get together, break up this old Jim Crow. Break it up now.
Morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, January 11th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. The question we should be asking is, would Mohammed Mahmoud have done what he did had he not been groomed to do it? He may have been arrested when he was 19. But this whole process began 2 years before. Muslim organizations across the country are asking the really serious questions. And Joe Biden is going after the gaming industry.